Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The cusp of autumn is barely upon us, and we need to shake as many leaves from the money trees as our needy hands are able to catch. So fill your baskets and buckets and bequeath them to KMUN, the genuinely public radio station on the North Oregon coast, reaching across the Columbia River to the south coast of Washington. Our fall pledge drive is now. Radio voices are hoarse from begging. Please leave us some dignity. Pledge now. My hope is that the rapidly changing demographics along the Oregon coast do not adversely affect public radio in this area. Its unfiltered presence is necessary. I dedicate today's program to Ronald L. Pierce, shot by a Viet Cong sniper 50 years ago yesterday, September 7, 1966. I have spoken of him before. He had a large tattoo of Christ in thorns that covered his back, which I have always since regretted not preserving. The penalty for his death was swift. Two villages annihilated and incinerated. I wish for you who are listening to think of those two villages while I narrate the following material that I wrote, and therefore owe a disclaimer that it is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in the universal firmament. And when you remember that Sunday is the 15th anniversary of 9/11, remember also the other 9/11, when the American CIA was the fulcrum of the overthrow and murder of Chile's elected President Salvador Allende on September 11, 1973. The worst day, 9/11 plus 15, which I wrote. Once upon a time in a fairy tale past, the United States of America thought it was safe from the strifes of the world, isolated by oceans its populace fatuously believed would protect it, even after half a century of a nuclear arms race and the development of intercontinental missiles. The USA assumed a Buck Rogers space shield would save it from harm. And from its inviolate fortress, it exported a highly sophisticated form of terror, attacking countries all over the world for one purpose or another, generally from the air with bombs and missiles, and increasingly robot drones and smart bombs. The USA pioneered many of the methods of war from the air and stratosphere, and used bombs more than any other nation, especially on cities and small villages of other nations. The morning of September 11, 2001 dramatically ended the nation's immunity. The USA was finally attacked in its homeland by suicidal commandos who made guided missiles of American airliners in a brilliant scheme of calculated devastation aimed at the cosmic cathedrals of American civilization and its manifest ambitions for global supremacy. September 11, 2001 turned the world upside down, which was the name of a popular song the British Army played on its fifes and drums as it marched out of Yorktown, Virginia, after losing the American Revolution to colonial rebels and terrorists in October 1781. 9/11 has been called the worst day in American history, the day that changed America forever. And for ideological expediency, the nation's history has been conflated into pre-9/11 and post-9/11. 9/11 has been used to declare a world war on terrorism, also as a corollary on ill-defined radical Islam as well. And like all such days of anguished trauma, 9/11 has become a myth of American solidarity in crisis, which, if there is any veracity to the blustering, vengeful xenophobia, this genuine partisan spirit lasted barely longer than the attack itself, despite the compulsive flag-waving spirit that seemed to suddenly sprout all over the country. American mass media, especially television, which is unable to resist hype and hyperbole, even amidst national tragedy, tried very hard to convince its readers and viewers that its lurid panorama of fervid patriotic ceremonies, the dog and pony babble of the usual hired talking heads speculating military strategies and responses, and the countless full-screen displays of flag-carrying Americans, that these visually verify that the nation as a whole demanded instant war and vengeance. Yet a passionate and significant debate was carried out all across the USA concerning exactly those war cries. It was reflected in blogs, public emails, and in the columns and letters pages of newspapers. Many writers wished revenge, and a number expressed that the U.S. must have the stomach to kill innocent persons, so-called collateral casualties, to get at terrorists. Many others placed security over liberty. Others gave President George W. Bush carte blanche to do what he thought necessary to win what he called the first war of the 21st century. But nearly half of the letter writers, and about as many columnists, cautioned patience and reason rather than vengeance and military retaliation. The forum inadvertently addressed the dilemma of a modern superpower. What does a colossus do when attacked by ferocious mice? It is likely the overuse of 9/11 as the bloody shirt, which brings to mind fables of little boys who too often cry wolf, led to a greater jeopardy of shutting off the national mindset to the real dangers that faced the faltering democracy, an unelected president, and his overt abuse of war powers being chief among them. As gruesome and immensely tragic as Tuesday, September 11, 2001 was, as well as the agony of its imprint on the American psyche, the Bush administration's alacrity to overflate the disaster to justify curtailing the Bill of Rights in the name of national security were egregious. The country's leaders reacted to 9/11 with a violence incomparable to what caused it, confusing reality with their own empirical ambitions. The causa belli of the Bush Jr. administration from its first day in the White House was to invade Iraq as the linchpin of a Middle East oil empire, and they shamelessly used 9/11 to curtail constitutional liberties in the name of national security far more rigidly than during the World Wars and the Cold War. Perhaps the most stifling consequence of 9/11 was its use to justify the most brazen power grab in the nation's history that got its major boost with Bush's selection as president by the Supreme Court, altering the already decrepit democracy into the Hamiltonian dream of a federalist autocracy of wealth and privilege in uneasy and possibly unmanageable alliance with right-wing Christian zealots who perceived this new millennium as fulfillment of horrendous prophecy, not to mention the opportunity to convert the USA into a militantly theolytical citadel of compulsory evangelical Christianity. The McDisney visions for this new century millennium were drastically and tragically revealed for the insipid fantasies they really were on 9/11, and it is a drastically different world we perceive for the future since. Yet it is the same old world of danger and death that it has always been, despite our near success at pretending it isn't. Our center of gravity has radically shifted, and we look out upon a newer milieu of uncertainty with feelings of grim anxiety that would be familiar to our earliest ancestors. The images of the captive passenger-filled suicide jet airliners crashing into both towers of the World Trade Center are indelible in the American psyche 15 years later, as familiar and cryptic as the smoking ribbons of Challenger shuttle 30 years ago in 1986. Other images recall 9/11, thousands of hands reaching up as if to stop the collapsing South Tower of the World Trade Center, falling bodies of people who jumped to their deaths to escape the fire started by the jets, in particular a couple holding hands as they fell, doomed firemen going up into the towers, passing survivors going down, the wreckage of a fourth skyjacked airliner forced to crash in Pennsylvania woods, short of its probable target of the White House or the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., by furious passengers who seemed fairly aware that everyone aboard would die regardless of their resistance. A woman on 9/11 morning in New York City described a surreal atmosphere of people standing on street corners, staring up at the flaming towers, and after they collapsed seemed to numbly look at the subsequent piles of rubble that was vast and several stories high. Another woman said she saw crowds of people walking away from Ground Zero, stunned after the towers pancaked to the ground. "Where are you going?" she asked. "Away," they said. The young daughter of a U.S. airline pilot said after 9/11, I play with my dolls and I think of Osama bin Laden. The dolls save the world sometimes, and sometimes they save the people in the airplanes. The funerals and memorials were soon over, and after nearly a year, most of the rubble at Ground Zero was cleaned up. Yet the national angst since 9/11 has been a highly charged subjective nightmare also, that a hijacked jet airplane loaded with helpless captives is aimed at all our windows. It is a nightmare that proved fruitful for the homeland fearmongers of the Bush administration, who kept the terrorist paranoia at high fever after 9/11, the day the calendar stopped whenever the Bushites were questioned or criticized about anything, especially the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Bush administration immediately used 9/11 to implement its Hamiltonian model of iron presidential powers it ludicrously called the unitary executive theory, which more or less sidelines constitutional restraints on presidential power. The Bushites attempted to persuade Americans that it is unpatriotic to defend political and civil liberties during times of crisis. Then Attorney General Ashcroft even claimed anyone complaining about loss of civil liberties only encourages the terrorists, he said. The administration dismissed criticism of its rape of the environment and disintegration of the always tenuous social fabric by intimating such criticism only aided and abetted terrorism. The USA Patriot Act was ramrodded through a Congress that neglected to read it for fear of being accused of being soft on terrorism a week after 9/11. A blatant attempt to use 9/11 to reorganize the USA into a corporate militocracy, and with their customary Orwellian doublethink, the Bushites claimed that increased governmental and police powers expanded personal liberties. The Bill of Rights were still operative where deemed appropriate, Attorney General Ashcroft said. In truth, the Patriot Act essentially sought to void the First Amendment and at least three others: Fourth Amendment freedom from unreasonable searches, Fifth and Sixth Amendment due process of law and protection of life, liberty, and property. The Patriot Act would certainly criminalize our original patriots, who were, after all, traitors and terrorists, and demands that present-day Americans comply and actually assist in the betrayal of principles those founding revolutionaries fought for and established 12 score years ago. The vehement mantra from the outset of 9/11 was that everything must be done to protect the USA from the rest of the world while simultaneously ensuring the rest of the world was vulnerable to the power and might of Captain America. This was the Bush Doctrine, under which the USA rapidly mutated into the sort of rogue nation it accuses others of being. It was not our values but our boorish abandonment of them the terrorists attacked on 9/11. Especially in the previous decades, our callous global policies made entire populations desperate and consequently ravaged our own security. Quite opposite the claims that the 9/11 terrorists struck the USA because it is the foundation of liberty, it has instead been the consistent opponent of democratic government in the Middle East and much of the Southern Hemisphere, supporting ruthless autocratic regimes it generally keeps on its tether through force or corruption. Those who committed the atrocity of 9/11 did not do it because they were evil, but because they perceived evil had been done to them, and they reciprocated as they were capable, which attained a brilliance of desperation. Although whoever attacked the home country are persistently regarded as cowardly terrorists, they undoubtedly thought of themselves as heroic Davids standing up against the gigantic juggernaut of Goliath to revenge contemporary and historical injustices. And whatever else they may have been, they were not cowards. Cowards do not willingly execute a long-planned operation that centers around their certain deaths. Terrorism has risen from our military arms and financial support of repressive and compliant regimes in Latin America, Asia, and the Middle East. Terrorism has become synonymous with anti-Americanism, and its intensity is in response to our zealously arrogant efforts to subdue liberties and freedoms we claim to exemplify. American Cold War policies of realpolitik did not endear us to much of the emerging world, which has suffered heavily under puppet despots the U.S. supported in the half-century conflict for world supremacy with the Soviet Union. Nor has it made the U.S. popular since 9/11, as we use war and the threat of war to control the supply of resources that sustain the American way of life, our political leaders of both parties claim as the mandate of God and Christianity. The USA uses up more of the world's resources than any other country, and more than many countries combined, and the people whose wealth we appropriate are denied their equitable shares, which makes them upset with us, and quite often violently resentful and desperate. For all its pious rant against terrorism, the United States is a major exporter of it, and has been since at least the advent of the Cold War. As a matter of interest, the USA is the only nation condemned by the World Court for International Terrorism, and it vetoed a United Nations Security Council resolution for all nations to observe international law, both of these in response to Nicaragua's protest against U.S. instigation and support of the so-called Contras, counter-revolutionary terrorists, whom Ronald Reagan praised as freedom fighters. Terrorism is usually depicted as the method of violence used against us, somewhat in the manner Robert Graves defined mythology as every religion but one's own. A major American reaction to 9/11 was that any wrong this country has done or will do to others is irrelevant. All that matters is the wrong done to us, dealt with as if it occurred in a vacuum. The U.S. government also interprets terrorism as any form of armed struggle against regimes it arms and supports, no matter how despotic or repressive. Quite disingenuously, the U.S. refused to acknowledge the World Court and avoided ratifying U.N.-sponsored international human rights covenants during the Bush years, smugly or sinisterly content to claim that our own democratic decorums are all that matter in our conduct of world affairs. In 1979, the UN passed a strong resolution against terrorism. The United States and Israel voted against it. Nothing in the resolution prohibits those fighting for just causes against repression and colonialism, those are in quotes. But apartheid South Africa was a U.S. ally at the time, so native freedom fighters were classified in the U.S. as terrorist forces. Rather than treat terrorists as international criminals to be captured and tried before the world court, the Bushites raised 9/11 to an apocalyptic struggle between good and evil, i.e., between evangelical Christians and everybody else. Osama bin Laden was transfigured from an ideological psychopath into a comic book Satan who must be destroyed by Captain America. The U.S. government rushed from an undeniable truth to a false conclusion, that because 3,000 or so persons were killed on 9/11, this nation declared a world war on terrorism and retaliated with magnitudes more violence than it suffered, as well as strong-armed every nation that did not sympathize with USA's unilateral declaration of war. We must think of terrorism in the larger sense before we can stop it. War inevitably kills innocent people, especially in our era when populations are the major targets, which makes war itself a major and persistent act of terrorism, of course denied as vociferously as armies deny rape. In particular, the favored concept of total war that dates back to biblical times and earlier, in which entire populations are subject to total annihilation, is not only the prerogative of governments and military institutions, but quite obviously of those who struggle against them with any means at hand, however horrible and catastrophic the results. It is often said that terrorism is the poor person's B-52, and obviously stratospheric bombers are far out of reach of defenseless peoples underneath them, as are also predator drone aircraft piloted from half a world away. Terrorism is overwhelmingly the weapon of the strong rather than the weak. When states commit terrorism, they have more resources than individuals or groups of terrorists. Terrorism is the calculated threat or use of violence to support ideological or political goals. The means or scale of violence determine the success or failure of terrorism. Violence or its threat is the leading principle of power. Terrorism inherently places ideology or other abstracts above human life, that of its perpetrators as well as its targeted victims. Terrorists who are willing to die, often their deaths are prerequisite of their terror, are generally noted for their contempt toward life and living. Terrorism is reprehensibly anti-human. Most acts considered inhuman are exclusively human. Whatever gains possibly accrued by terrorism are eroded by the inherent callousness, however bitter or desperate, of its use. Though the so-called higher ideal is a terrorist usually proclaimed manifesto, terrorism in its precalculated callousness yet precludes any claim an ideology can make toward idealism or respect for human life. It can therefore be regarded as indefensible, whether used or endorsed by a state or a group of individuals, no matter the integrity of their claim. The United Nations itself is unable to adequately define terrorism, perhaps because many of its member nations have been created and continue to expand their influence and power through various forms of terrorism or continents of it. The United States, as a result of 9/11, has committed itself to a virtually perpetual war when it has been unnecessary. A grievous crime was perpetrated against the USA, but not one that was undeserved or should have been so unexpected. We have lived a long time in a false bubble that whatever we do elsewhere in the world will not in similar measure reach us. When we should seek justice for a crime, we have instead responded with war. And in the 15 years since 9/11, we have murdered many times more innocents without trial and certainly without justice as died on 9/11. In Iraq alone, the estimate of civilian or so-called collateral deaths exceeds 100,000. We claim these deaths are by accident and not intent, which our apologists, who are also the perpetrators, assure us is much different than the planned murders of 9/11. But war is murder on a mass scale, and we allowed ourselves to be led to war with barely any resistance. So these murders are at our door. We are as guilty as terrorists. A major distinction between just wars and unjust wars, made in medieval times by the Christian Church to justify its religious wars, is equally or more important in regard to a war's conduct as it is to its reason or purpose. The primary distinction is the prohibition of intentionally targeting civilians in a war to be considered a just war, nor should disproportionate force be used. But as the wholesale bombings of cities in World War II indicate, the differences are too often degrees of propaganda than reality. The 9/11 attack on the USA was most assuredly a crime against humanity and a violation of international law because it specifically targeted civilians, which is essentially why U.S. apologists are hasty to assure that every civilian casualty from bombing or other military action since 9/11 has been purely accidental and quite simply a consequence of war rather than premeditated murder. But just as surely as innocents are killed in war, the devastating and unprecedented attack on 9/11 was not directed at the World Trade Center and Pentagon and perhaps the White House as mere symbols of American power, but instead as the true center of the USA's political, economic, and militarily global supremacy. That was certainly the perspective of those who elaborately planned and executed the attacks. They regarded those who were employed in those two centers, and surely the White House, as directly responsible for American actions around the world. In a total war, everybody is a soldier, which was the ultimate rationale of the mass bombings of cities in World War II, and certainly the use of two atomic bombs on Japanese cities, which ushered in the nuclear age and its iconic mushroom cloud that has apocalyptically billowed over nearly everything since. The attack on Pearl Harbor 75 years ago on December 7, 1941, was the main analogy drawn for 9/11, complete surprise, a direct hit on the USA's symbols of wealth and power, epic destruction. The anger and instant desire for revenge were about the same as Pearl Harbor. Also, the heart-wrenching sense of tragedy and the immediate finger-pointing at why 9/11 was allowed to happen. Suspicion of government foreknowledge of 9/11 has also been a Pearl Harbor legacy, and like Pearl Harbor, 9/11 has served for the last decade and a half as a rallying cry for revenge and war. "You're either with us or against us," Bush Jr. declared unilaterally to the rest of the world. From the beginning, his stance has been the official American mantra of 9/11, that cowardly terrorists from radical Islam, jealous of our democratic way of life, were fanatically determined to destroy the USA, and that we Americans must preempt their evil ways by hunting terrorists everywhere in the world forever. There are questions about 9/11. The most extreme claim is that it was planned and set in motion at the highest levels of the U.S. government, or at least these upper cadres knew about the terrorist intentions but did nothing to prevent the attack. Certainly, Bush had been warned that an attack was imminent, but he ignored it. It is more than remotely possible the real conspiracy of terror against the USA is inspired by the at the highest levels in Saudi Arabia. Most of the 9/11 kamikazes were from there, as was, of course, the late Osama bin Laden, whose family had a long-time business entanglement with the Bush family. Saudi Arabians in covert collusion with the Saudi monarchy have been at the center of world terrorism for decades with little U.S. opprobrium, essentially because of Arabian oil. As much paranoid spook literature projects, there might be infinite layers of intrigue, even conceivable that separate agendas coalesce for reasons of opportunity or expedience, such as the Bush and bin Laden families in Gray Conspiracy. War and peace are not abstracts. They are as personal as coitus and death. The way to eradicate evil is certainly not by murdering women, children, and men. The world has been a slaughterhouse throughout history. This year, 2016, for example, is the 917th anniversary of the sack of Jerusalem and the massacre of its population of Muslims and Jews by European Christians during the First Crusade in 1099. Any cry for more slaughter goes straight back to our bloody past of claw and fang. We are a global civilization, like it or not. Nuclear weapons rendered the nation state as dead as dinosaurs. An anthropogenic climate change makes us all, though not equally, vulnerable. And if the so-called global economy is rigged to benefit only a few wealthy nations and multinational corporations, rather than act as a worldwide structure meant to include everybody in equal protections and freedoms, then the nightmare of 9/11 is only an advent of a darker future. Two warring orthodoxies claim God and right on their side, one with an arsenal capable of atomizing the world to oblivion, the other armed with comparatively inferior weapons, yet with imaginatively destructive intentions of their use that are defined euphemistically as low-density warfare. They have shown themselves able to attack anywhere in the world with passionate fury and calculating homicidal suicide. This so-called war of civilizations is at the root of a problem that inhibits a truly world civilization that has long been a held dream, at least for dreamers, philosophers, pacifists, and humanitarians, weary of the interminable wars between tribes, cultures, religions, and nations. Here is the seemingly irresolvable problem that threatens humanity with possible annihilation. Here, the best and worst traits of humanity are evident at every level and clash head-on. Human civilization is on the brink of something dire and awesome. Palestine, Israel, is the focal point of a vortex that might very well obliterate civilization. The possibility of World War III is invoked. The final conflict predicted for millennia and possibly encouraged by millenarians. It would be a grotesque irony that humanity, hopelessly mired in the irredeemable past, perishes because it is unable to resolve the conflicts from its earliest history. And I'd like to finish with a poem by Jesse Duncan, September 11th. Thunder in the wind, no rain, peace mourns its passing, no pain. We are still human, but our existence is vain. Do we not bleed and die? It is always the same refrain. Nothing is right. Terrorism shakes its ugly mane. Are we not all human? Do we not feel pain? Peace comes to an end as the old moon wanes. Jets fly overhead. We decide to take trains. We are struck by horror. We are struck by pain. What do we do when the time comes again? Send our boys into battle. Watch them die in vain. Peace waves goodbye as war says hello again. Jesse Duncan wrote this poem right after 9/11 when she was 16 and a student at Astoria High School. She had spent the summer as a member of the cast of Shanghai in Astoria. Her poem appeared in the January 2002 North Coast Times Eagle. And this has been Michael McCusker. Pledge now.